I'm very happy indeed to be here this evening. I received several telephone calls from Wheaton and instructions in writing and through the phone how to get to Wheaton. We had also a distinguished alumnus from Wheaton with us to guide us. And this apparently was not enough. It seems the organizers, I felt very grateful for the special attention they gave me, but somehow I feel that one of the organizers knew what happened to me a few years back at Fenimore near Boscobel, Wisconsin. I was asked to address a Methodist church on the Dead Sea Scrolls. I was there on time. It was a very beautiful May evening. I asked the first person I met, where is the Methodist church? He said, down the road, sir. I went to the church. I had a wonderful supper. After supper, the program chairman turned to me and said, Professor Johnson, will you tell me something about your background? I told him I'll be very happy, but first of all, I don't look like a Professor Johnson, and secondly, I'll be very happy to tell you something about my background. I took my letter and showed it to him and said, I'm really sorry. This is the Lutheran church. The Methodist church is across the street. Well, I know you don't believe it. I went across the street. Professor Johnson was there. So I told Professor Johnson, how is that we two intellectuals could make such errors? He said, Mansour, you speak for yourself. I came to the right place, and only when I saw you there, I thought I was in the wrong place. And anyhow, it was ended by inviting him for a drink, and we made peace over that. It's really, for many years now, I wanted very much to participate in this a conference. I think had I known earlier, a few years back, of course I would have been here just to come and be a member of the audience. And I'm really happy to be here. I know you have been pioneers in the field of biblical archaeological teaching. We had, and I'm not just saying to please you, we had several students from Wheaton, and they really were very impressed by their academic background. And it's a distinct honor and privilege for myself and my colleagues to be here. I'm afraid some of the things we may raise has been mentioned this afternoon, but very briefly. But the topic of my paper this evening, as you know, the book and the spade, the relevance of biblical archaeology today. A public interest in biblical archaeology is really staggering. We held a three-week exhibit in biblical archaeology at the University. Some of you I know were there. This is no exaggeration. Over 85,000 persons of 3.5 weeks. Perhaps we, as inquisitive human beings, our common origins, our common heritage, and our past, based on that exhibit. An American newspaper publisher and owner of a large newspaper syndicate once told his reporters, and this is taken from the Reader's Digest, people today are interested in three things: inflation, sex, and archaeology, in that order. That's what he told them. I'm not going to debate priorities, but certainly people do have lively interest in biblical and Near Eastern archaeological discoveries. The fascination of archaeology, I was told, by the way, that this is a public lecture, not for the experts. The fascination of archaeology comprises the hunt for hidden treasure, the fact-finding and clue-finding of the detective, and the appeal of piecing together diverse evidence to fill gaps in our knowledge of history. Really a kind of intelligent work directed backwards. Someone really gave me a definition of archaeology as Archaeology is a science in which progress can be measured by the advance made backward into the past. To some people, the word archaeology suggests something as dry as dust, a career followed by elderly, long-bearded professors. To others, especially youngsters, the word is full of romance, suggesting buried treasures, a rugged life in the wide open spaces, and buried cities revealed by the spade. Neither idea is very close to the truth. Archaeology, in my view, is a scientific study and involves skilled and laborious work. Sometimes startling discoveries are made, such as Jericho, Tutankhamun's tomb, and the Dead Sea Scrolls, but almost without exception, they are the reward of many years' work without spectacular results. Yet, during the past century, few departments of human studies have shown more remarkable progress in scientific techniques or yielded more significant results than archaeology, and especially biblical archaeology. It has made possible the reconstruction of both the life of the ancient Near East and the material and spiritual background of that great book, the Bible. The last 100 years of archaeology have added a score of centuries to the story of the growth of man's Western culture and his religious heritage as the ancient world has been recovered from the sands and caves of the modern Near East. Progress has been truly phenomenal. Interest in biblical history and in the Bible itself has no doubt played an important role in this remarkable achievement. Today, we know more about man's history than any generation before us. Yet, to the detriment of our nation, as Albright put it once, until very recently, we have given the past too little respect. This is not the fault of our times. Unfortunately, there had been and still is in some circles a well-known tendency on the part of leading American functionalists in the disciplines of social sciences to downgrade history. These scholars refuse to consider history and our past heritage as having much significance for us today or for our future. Their views are based on the principle that we should follow only scientific technique of experiment rather than depend upon experience of the past. This trend was perhaps largely responsible until quite recently for the plight of the humanities in the universities in contrast with the sciences. But as Albright observed, that a new element has recently entered the picture. The extraordinary contemporary triumph of world archaeology and particularly Near Eastern archaeology. This has brought about important changes. The two fields in which most progress has been made in the 20th century, it has been asserted, are nuclear science and biblical archaeology. The linking of these two disciplines is not merely incidental. Progress in nuclear science represents the creativeness of the human mind. The Bible and biblical archaeology are man's spiritual heritage. The confusion resulting from the two futile world wars has prompted man to turn to his origins. Since World War II, there has been a revolutionary revival of interest in the history of the ancient Near East, the cradle of human civilization, and in the origins of the Judeo-Christian heritage which formed the foundation of Western civilization. This new interest, in my opinion, is the greatest contribution of the Dead Sea Scrolls too, and now Ebla. No wonder the federal government has established the National Endowment for the Humanities and poured millions of dollars to support research in the humanities. I think the humanities have never had it so good as they do as today. Progress in biblical archaeology has been so considerable that the span of recorded history for all practical purposes, and I'm not exaggerating, I know there are many of my colleagues who know better about this, that the span of recorded history has been more than doubled since the beginning of this century. And I'd like to explain that. History, as you know, begins with written records. At the beginning of this century, we could trace our recorded history to about 1500 BC or so, or 3500 years ago. Today, we can go as far back as 6000 BC, or even 7000 BC, almost double. The world-renowned British archaeologist Dame Kathleen Kenyon told us 2 years ago that, as seen in Jericho, the history of civilization has been more than tripled, and she goes back to 9000 BC. Today we know the history of southwestern Asia and Egypt after about 2600 BC far better than our own great-grandfathers knew the history of Europe in the 6th or 7th century AD. Thanks to archaeology, the historical background of the Bible, down to minor details, were expected even elucidation. These conclusions may seem exaggerated, but besides the mass of self-evident data which has emerged from archaeological investigation, accuracy has been assured by the thorough way in which the natural sciences are now becoming essential partners to the interpretation of these data. Archaeology has indeed entered the realm of science. But in dealing with biblical archaeology, we have not only unwritten documents, such as artifacts made by human hands, including cities, fortresses, public buildings, houses and tombs, even household objects, but also all ancient written objects found in excavation and in exploration. Since the Bible is a collection of writing, we shall naturally learn more about it from written sources than from those not in writing. Yet, writing without artifacts, as someone put it, is like flesh without a skeleton, and artifacts without writing are a skeleton without flesh. Both must be considered in biblical archaeology. The tantalizing thing about biblical archaeology, and I'll never give up that term, biblical archaeology, as long as I live. The tantalizing thing about biblical archaeology is that often we uncover both artifacts and writing. We find jars and potsherds with names of kings and officers from the biblical period. The same historical events recorded in the Bible and the Akkadian inscriptions, names of gods and goddesses in Canaanite and Israelite stone tablets, corroborating and supplementing one another. It's always exciting to find especially names such as King Jotham, as Nelson Glick once described the excitement when an Arab boy handed him a seal with King Jotham's name on it, or Hezekiah. Although I do hope and pray one day we will find a stone that will tell us King Solomon slept here too. In understanding all these things, every branch of science is now enlisted in archaeology, nuclear physics, chemistry, geology, geography, botany, zoology, and other branches of biology, even medicine. One example, it was carbon-14 tests conducted by physicists that confirmed the date reached by scholars, Bible scholars, and that enabled us to date the now famous Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, because of the scientific methods applied, archaeology has become, in a very real sense, the scientific laboratory of history. We have heard about the relation between history and the Bible, in the Bible, and I may repeat some of these things. The more we know, I think, the better, the more we hear it. It has the new scientific study of archaeology has set the Bible, the whole Bible, once again at the center of history. Indeed, science has mastered the archaeologist, but at the same time, archaeology has mastered the scientist himself. In the case of biblical archaeology, the scientist has not only been inspired, but has also contributed considerably to its success. K. Chemists, physicists, and engineers are working today side by side with the archaeologists and Bible scholars. Now archaeology can add greatly to our understanding of biblical background and the historical events in it. But again, I wish to emphasize what my colleague said this afternoon in the name of Nelson Glick, that archaeology does not, cannot, and should not be utilized to prove or disprove the Bible. You hear it, and I really believe only sensationalists can try to use biblical archaeology for that purpose. I personally hold it as a general rule that when an archaeological find like the Dead Sea Scrolls confirms a statement or historical event in the Bible, it's the Bible that proves that the archaeological find is authentic. Since it's mentioned in the Bible, which had been faithfully transmitted to us for at least 2,000 years, and not the other way around. Indeed, a great archaeologist, Nelson Glick, as you heard already, believed that people who seek to validate religious concepts by archaeological finds are simply confusing fact with faith, history with tradition, and science with religion. The Bible does not require archaeology to come to its rescue. As Professor Hirth, I think, said this afternoon, we don't need archaeology to reach the Almighty God. In fact, the vast majority of finds neither prove nor disprove. They just fill in the background and give setting to the biblical story. We heard, biblical archaeology, therefore, is not an instrument to prove the historicity of the scriptures, but to correlate to, as someone said this afternoon, to illuminate the biblical narrative into a historical framework, and to throw light on the setting in which the biblical drama was cast. There's a vast difference between history in the Bible, says Nelson Glick, and the Bible as history. The unity and authenticity of the Bible stems from the fact that its undeviating and single purpose is to expound the uniqueness, universality, and the significance of God of Israel for all mankind. But at the same time, history is relevant to biblical archaeology since faith was communicated in different ways of expression through the forms of history, such as the Exodus, for instance. I'm convinced the person who recorded the event of Exodus had no historical concept in his mind. All he wanted to do, the role of God in history. In that event, he didn't know even the word history. Without biblical history, one cannot fully comprehend biblical faith, which in turn affirms the meaning of history. We cannot therefore assume that the knowledge of biblical history is unessential to faith. Biblical theology and biblical archaeology must go hand by hand if we are to grasp the meaning of the biblical message, but with one provision. It must be objectively, honestly being pursued. For the most part, archaeology has substantiated and illuminated the biblical story at so many crucial points that no one today can seriously say that the biblical events are little more than a collection of myth or legend. There are very few people, if any, who say this thing these days thanks to archaeology. Yet, all leading archaeologists, Yadin, Kenyon, Albright, Wright, and Glick, and others, I've checked, I really spent more time to prepare this talk because I had to give it elsewhere almost the same, more than anything, and I tried to check all my sources. And all these, without exception, believe that while there is much in the Bible that can be and has been confirmed archaeologically, there is much more which cannot and need not and will never be historically substantiated simply because faith and belief in God is not subject to scientific inquiry. Indeed, the full value of biblical archaeology can be achieved, again says Nelson Glick, only when it's pursued for the objective. And Nersingleik was a great believer. And he himself came with this conclusion, as any archaeologist, biblical archaeologist in my view, will reach this conclusion once he works on it, that only when it is pursued for the objective historical information that biblical archaeology almost always so richly yields, but when scientifically undertaken. We must remember that the biblical archaeologist is primarily concerned with recovering the story of the peoples associated with the Bible so that we may obtain clearer insight concerning the message of the Bible. We must always remember that he can deal only with evidence which reveals history and its setting and with data on its culture, including religion. Whether or not his discoveries will support or deny the dogmas of any religious group is beyond the responsibility of the archaeologist. And I still believe there's no archaeologist worthy of his name who will try to make sure that the discovery will support his own view. He goes perhaps with this hope that whatever he's going to do is going to support his view. We can spell out the record the archaeologist must spell out the record as he sees it. He may even be able to recover enough information to document a political or social history of ancient periods. As we saw the story of the Moabite stone, that the Moabite who rebelled against Israel and were victorious devoted, I think, 28 lines for their victory. The Bible has 4 or 5 lines about it because it was defeated, and especially the king was a wicked king. But when you put these two together, you get a perfect historical record. And that's really the greatness, perhaps, of the inscriptions that we find in biblical archaeology. So we find the archaeology can document political and social history of the ancient periods. This happened. He may even discover cult objects and relics and religious records which tell something of the beliefs and practices of an ancient people, and that this people believed that their gods or gods led them to victory over a neighboring people. This too has happened. For instance, the Bible tells us about the Canaanite cult, the pagan fertility rites, the gods and goddesses and all that. Now we have many artifacts from tablets describing this cult, and thus the Bible texts become better understood and clearer. As you will see again in the film, some of these cults and the instruments. But there has also been a great deal of nonsense written about discrepancies and contradictions in the Bible. Again, it must be remembered that reconstructing history is quite impossible unless we have different views of just what happened at a given time, at different reactions of contemporaries or successors, as we do. They are not contradictions, but just different views as we have them today. We heard a lady this afternoon in this hall. He said, no happy marriage without dissensions and different views. That's exactly here too, in a sense. Minor discrepancies do not invalidate historicity. They are necessary components of any true history of man. This is now being provided by archaeology. In the light of our new data gleaned from archaeology, the main purpose of the scholars today is to interpret the Bible as fully as possible from this new evidence. The result is overwhelmingly favorable to the biblical record, and over again, reinterpretations of biblical concepts and phraseology and the language in the light of archaeology make the Bible more meaningful today. Perhaps that's the reason that every few years we see a new translation of the Bible into English, because of the new light that archaeology is discovering. The more we know about the world of the Bible, the brighter becomes the light shed on the historical relations of man to his God. Talking about translation, it was a very inspiring visit I had 2 years ago in Greece, in Athens, where a number of scholars, and I know at least one from Wheaton College, were working on the new International Bible Translation, I think it's called, including some of our own students. And that's a good thing about it. It wasn't one point of view, but a collective point of view. In dealing with the Bible from the standpoint of modern archaeological discovery, one must remember that the Bible is both divine, since it rests on divine inspiration, but also human, since it has come to us through human channels. And bear in mind, to err is human. If we see discrepancy, it doesn't mean there's something wrong in the inscription or in the Bible, but it's just the human element in the transmission of the Hebrew Bible. Well, we know even today, it doesn't matter how careful you are, there are misprints in every book. There is a very famous Bible not far from here at St. Louis Library that was displayed in our exhibit. It's called the Wicked Bible. This is, by the way, a fact, and they call it that because in the commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, the word not was inadvertently omitted. And they tried really to recall. I'm telling you, this is a fact. You'll see it in any book on history of the Bible, and anyone who wants to see this Bible, I think you'll see it maybe in the film, but we borrowed it from the St. Louis Concordia Library. Just to show you that this can be helped. It's not, God forbid, something wrong with the Bible. Many historical events in the Bible have been corroborated by discoveries in Mesopotamia, Syria, and Palestine. The archaeologist's procedure for working a site in Israel or Jordan paralleled perfectly the scientific technique of a colleague digging in an ancient Babylonian, Greek, or an American Indian mound. His approach must be that of a scientist, that the evidence which he brings to light supports the biblical narrative is of a secondary consideration, and it should be to the archaeologist, not to the others. His primary purpose is to learn. Whether he is a biblical archaeologist, Syro-Palestinian archaeologist, or American Indian archaeologist, they all have the same purpose. In fact, after listening to my colleague about the economic and financial problems of the field archaeologist, I'm really happy I'm not one of them. But perhaps just as the late J.F. Kennedy told the Germans, Ich bin ein Berliner, I can truly say Ich bin ein biblical archaeologist too. A word of caution here, however, is not out of place. One fact is undisputed. Archaeology reveals documents and facts. However revealing, interesting, and new this may be, they are not enlightening in themselves alone. Conclusions must be drawn from them. And for that purpose, I agree with a writer who said the documents must be properly observed during the process of discovery, classified, correlated, and interpreted using all possible scientific aids and tools. Even in doing that, no human scholar, however hard he may strive to achieve objectivity, can help avoiding his own subconscious personal bias, I'm convinced. Doesn't matter how try you hard, you are a human being, and you still have your own subconscious bias. Doesn't matter how hard you try to be objective. And these, by the way, are the saints and the scholars, the good guys, I'd like to call them. On the other hand, we know of scholars who deal with these problems with deliberate and intentional bias in which their personal approaches and theories are involved, resulting in chaotic or even fantastic and dangerous conclusions. Hence the frequent differences of opinion on various biblical archaeological discoveries and concepts, notably in the case of the Dead Sea Scrolls, almost prevailing to this day. Examples of such misuse and abuse of archaeological evidence are many, both in unimportant trifles and in significant matters. These deliberate misinterpretations have caused distortions of major issues and have afflicted both biblical and archaeological study until to this day. Unfortunately, the most biased interpretation of archaeological evidence is in connection with the Bible, expectedly, in the realm of religious concepts, usually causing alarm and confusion among the lay public. The Dead Sea Scrolls are a good illustration. At one time, they were totally rejected by some as forgery, because some scholars and writers at first feared they might contradict the Hebrew Bible and undermine the uniqueness of Christianity and the history of the Bible. Once the texts of the scrolls were published, this belief proved to be completely unsupported. You may recall in May 1955, the discovery was made in 1947, but until 1955, hardly anyone except people working, Bible students and others, heard of this term, Dead Sea Scrolls. When Edmund Wilson, in May 1955, published a long article, almost the entire issue of the New Yorker. In my view, I read it very well. I knew him. He came to Johns Hopkins University to learn Hebrew in 3 weeks in order to interpret the scrolls. Then he went to the Dead Sea area. He met wonderful people like Allegro and DeFonso Mare and a few others. And he came back, had a fantastic story. It was really the best description of the discovery and contents in my view. But his conclusions were really all wrong. As you recall, he charged that religious leaders and theologians, especially Orthodox Jews and Catholics, he said, were hanging back in their task of deciphering the scrolls, lest they find in them something detrimental to their faith. He was certain that we should seek the origins of Christianity in the caves near the Dead Sea and not in the traditional places like Jerusalem, Bethlehem, because he said baptism was not unique. And I don't want to go into all these details, but once the scrolls were published, he proved entirely wrong. Even the baptism that he claimed it was pre-Christian, for that sect of the scrolls, baptism meant daily dipping several times a day, whereas in Christianity, a single personal initiatory act, and scholars failed to see the sensational statement that he made. But the one thing good about it, thanks to Edmund Wilson, the entire English-speaking world is interested in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and really is helping us with making our living these days. Thanks to that too, as far as me, myself personally, I had a midget tape recorder around my shoulder. I don't know, I'm sure some of you may have heard this series. And I interviewed 30 scholars from California to Jerusalem on the Dead Sea Scrolls. Not one endorsed Allegro's or Edmund Wilson's views. I wrote to Edmund Wilson at the time. He died 2 years ago, as you know. And he sent back a card with various boxes, and the boxes he did, he's too busy to meet me for the interview, but somehow fate brought us together. His son was my student at the University of Wisconsin, and before his final exam, I told him, either you flunk or you arrange an appointment with your father. And that one, our study of biblical archaeology must be objective. It must be devoted to the scientific truth, not the sacred truth. Sacred truth does not need archaeology. I'll have to emphasize this again and again. One is objective effect, the other is spiritual and subjective faith. I do not believe that any discovery is likely to shake our faith unless it's deliberately misinterpreted or purposely distorted, as in the case of the scroll. Perhaps a typical bias by one scholar can be illuminated by the investigations of the well-known professor John Allegro, a scholar formerly from the University of Manchester. Several years ago, if you recall, Allegro published published an irresponsible article, The Untold Story of the Dead Sea Scrolls, A Threat to Christianity? Thus couched in the form of a question, the article then made its point by subtle implication and insinuation. Its main allegation was that Christian scholars, especially Catholics, unable to deal with the scrolls objectively because of their religious commitments, had been exercising a boycott and withholding the text. That was his view. That's really plain nonsense. He particularly attacked religious leaders and theologians. His accusations were, to say the least, a most unkind and unjustified attack on the integrity of the international team working on the scrolls, his own colleagues, and many host of other leading scholars, leading theologians, and religious leaders. It's interesting, when I gave even my first talk, my inaugural talk as founder of the department in Wisconsin, they asked me to speak on the scrolls because I arrived in September 1955. That was the year that Edmund Wilson made the Dead Sea Scrolls very famous. And the newspaper, on a Friday before my Sunday lecture, they spoke about what a wonderful guy I am, and that I am a great religious leader and theologian who will speak on the Dead Sea Scrolls, just at the time when Edmund Wilson was attacking every religious leader and theologian. I phoned the Capital Times, and I told him, this is very flattering, but I happen not to be a religious leader. He asked me, what are your interests then in the scrolls? I told him, purely scholarly. He said, well, we'll do something about it. So the next day, they had a statement in the newspaper, Professor Mansour's interest in religion is purely scholarly. Since then, I never question what the newspaper write. A few years ago, Allegro again came out with another bombshell, the most fantastic theory about God, Judaism, and Christianity, in the form of a book, some of you may have heard it, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. It was so sensational, and unfortunately, maybe thousands of people read it because of these sensational statements that he made, and yet, in my view, it was not worth even the paper it was printed on. Allegro first turned agnostic, then moved to outright doubt as to the historical existence and background of Christianity, including Judaism and Islam for that matter. God, according to him, is symbolically a large red mushroom. His theory is given in terms of dangerous linguistic distortions, exploiting drugs, rites, and cults to the full to prove his fantasy trip. And by the way, he ended as a drug addict. He set himself up against the entire scholarly establishment. In reading Allegro's book, I was so often reminded of Alice through the looking glass. But glory doesn't mean a nice knockdown argument, Alice retorted. When I use a word, Humpty Dumpty said in a rather scornful tone, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less. The question is, said Alice, whether you can make words mean so many different things. The question is, said Humpty Dumpty, which is to be the master? That's all. All I can say, happily for us, Allegro is not the master. When his book appeared in London, by the way, top scholars in the field, in this country and abroad, including Allegro's own colleagues, wrote a letter to the London Times denouncing it as a sheer nonsense. Not a single review was favorable, and the book was called everything from a philologist's erotic nightmare to a case, quote, of Allegro capriccio troppo, unquote. Last summer, a colleague in England told me that there was only one person so far that has accepted Allegro's theory, and that was Mrs. Allegro, for the sake of peace at home. Well, these are those guys. On the other hand, many contributions, no doubt, made by archaeologists toward a better understanding of biblical accounts. I'll just give few examples, and with this I hope to end. Excavations at the famous biblical city of Ur, spelled U-R, in Iraq, prove that about 2000 BC, during the age of the patriarchs Abraham, there existed an organized community, an educated priesthood, a knowledge of many arts and crafts, and a fully developed pagan religion, just as the Bible says. This discovery is of great significance since, according to the Hebrew tradition, Ur is the city from which Abraham, the ancestor of the Hebrews, set out to seek a new country and reveal a new concept of God. And this really fits perfectly at that time. In the now uncovered streets of Ur, we can see what sort of houses men lived in, what household utensils mentioned the Bible they used, what gods they worshipped. We have pictures, we have samples of them, and how they conducted their business correspondence. In short, all the details of a daily life at the age of Abraham. We may never be able to prove that Abraham really existed, although no one knows. Really, the miracles taking place all the time in archaeology. What we can prove is that his life and times, as reflected in biblical stories about him, fit perfectly within the early second millennium, about 2000 BC, as revealed by excavation at Ur and elsewhere, but imperfectly within any later period. There's one little point in connection with Ebla. I thought I'll mention Ebla, but I know you have heard too much of Ebla. But there's only one point. Among the names, if you recall, besides Sodom and Gomorrah, which is really, according to some, that's the only place where it's mentioned outside the Bible, archaeologically speaking. And by the way, according to Pettinato and Friedman, that Sodom and Gomorrah are described in the Ebla as suffered a violent disaster. They didn't say not Sin City or anything, but this is how it's there. For the Bible, of course, it has to be because of their sins. But the other point, among the names that you have heard, that is, one was Abramo. Not our Abraham, but at least a name. The name was Karen. Abraham is a Hebraized name. Again, here's indirect corroboration that such a name as Abram, not Abraham, did exist, just exactly what the Bible says, that his original name was Abram. Let's go further. An Arab farmer's chance discovery in North Syria in 1928 brought about the uncovering of hundreds of tablets written in a hitherto unknown language, Ugaritic and cuneiform. The cuneiform signs proved to constitute an alphabetical script, the first alphabet in history, dated 1400 BC. These Ugaritic texts have illuminated the religion as well as the moral and social conditions of the ancient Canaanites and have provided much linguistic help for a better understanding of the poetical sections of the Hebrew Bible. Indeed, one of the most rewarding studies resulting from archaeology is the story of man's greatest invention, namely the alphabet. Another interesting discovery, a farmer's calendar found in the biblical city of Gezer and dated by archaeologists to the time of King David around 900 BC, is one piece of the evidence by which the science has now established that the knowledge of writing was more common in the Near East and at a much earlier date than scholars suppose 50 or 60 years ago. This ancient Hebrew tablet contains a list of the farming operations appropriate to each month of the year, and it indicates that even an ordinary peasant in biblical times could read and write as early as the 10th century BC. This corroborates many references to writing in the Bible, and it's extremely significant for our understanding of the transmission of the biblical records. What has emerged strikingly, and we see that, by the way, I wrote that before I checked with Ebla, what has emerged strikingly from scientific archaeology in our day in the Near East is how closely knit the world of antiquity was. Evidently, there was freedom of movement and communication in the 18th century or 14th century BC, no less than in the 20th century AD, each in its own way. As a result, thanks to archaeology in this century and the dedication of scholars, scientists, and sometimes goats, our knowledge of the history, literature, and religion of the Bible has been greatly enriched. For the archaeologist, however, the main guide is the Bible itself. Today, archaeologists and prospectors are finding oil, copper, water, and other minerals in the Holy Land right where the Bible said they were. I'll just really refer to two out of the many examples I have. Water is always a problem, as you know, in a land that's more than half desert. That's why it is startling today to come suddenly upon a swimming pool complete with diving board in the middle of the bleak Negev, the southern arid desert in Israel. The pool is the result, according to Nelson Glick, of a research conducted by archaeologists near a kibbutz settlement called Yotvata, after the biblical name in Deuteronomy, Jotbath, J-O-T-H-Bath, Jotbath. The biblical clue to the water was found in the story of the wanderings of the children of Israel with Moses. As told, quote, they were giving really a list of the journeys and a list of the encampment. From there, the Bible says the children of Israel journeyed into Gudgoda and from Gudgoda to Jotbath. Many names were given, but only here after Jotbath, the Bible added a land of river and waters, only in reference to this city out of 20 or 30 cities mentioned. There are several references to the places, as I said, where the Israelites wandered in the desert, but only names were given. But here it added the land of rivers and waters. Since the Bible says there is water in Yotvata, they dug in the entire area and eventually they searched for it and found it in underground spring. And that's the reason they can afford a swimming pool. Before directing the excavation at the biblical city of Hazor, Yigael Yadin told us that he studied the biblical account of the city wherever it occurred, and from it prepared a list to his workmen, itemizing not only the fortified walls and the so-called stables of King Solomon, but also the objects they could expect to find. To the workmen's amazement, but not to Yadin's, they have so far found everything the Bible said was there, including the Canaanite altar and the city gate. Finally, one more illustration of wide interest. We have all heard of Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor who, according to the New Testament, was the judge in the trial and execution of Jesus. Yet the first inscription outside the coin, uncovered, bearing the name Pontius Pilate, Roman governor of Judea between 26 and 36 AD, was found only in 1961 by two Italian archaeologists in the course of excavations near Caesarea, which we know was the Roman capital of the province of Judea in Jesus' days. The name was found on a tablet, probably used in the dedication of a statue or monument. Three lines in Latin are inscribed on it. We have the slides. We can show it to you tomorrow if you wish. The first read Tiberium, the name of the Roman emperor that we know at the time. The second reads Pontius Pilatus. The third line was mutilated, has not yet really been deciphered. Yet, until this discovery, the name of Pontius Pilate was known to us only from contemporary writings of the Jewish historian Josephus or from the Gospels, but not from Roman or Greek inscriptions, except, as I told you, on a coin. Some scholars, even Christian scholars, doubted the historicity of this personality and even questioned the historical events recorded in the Gospels. According to the highly respected Interpreter's Bible, if you want to check, I did, modern scholarly judgment had held Pilate's role as depicted in the New Testament, quote, to be largely legendary, unquote. For this reason alone, this new discovery has great historical significance in relation to New Testament accounts. The late Nelson Glick told us once the secret of his phenomenal success in archaeology. By the way, you'll excuse the commercial because I know many of you are doing the same thing. We have a group that we take every summer. It's called Seminar in the Lands of the Bible. We are conducting our 15th seminar. But when Nelson Glick and Wright were alive, every year we met them in Jerusalem to learn the latest about biblical archaeology. And in one memorable visit, Nelson Glick told us, "I've always gone on the assumption that the historical statements of the Bible are true. I live by this faith in the biblical text. On that basis," he said, "I've made some of my most important finds," unquote. For any archaeologist or Bible scholars, as for Glick, this is the essential relationship between archaeology, which is search for fact, and the Bible, which is search for and acceptance of faith. The lessons of the past, as every archaeologist will discover sooner or later, are indeed humbling ones. They are also useful ones. For if anything is clear, it is that we cannot dismiss any part of our human story as irrelevant to the future of mankind. We want to know more and learn more. This is really perhaps the magic of biblical archaeology. Knowing the past, as in history, is a useful way to prepare for the future. This is perhaps why the Book and the Spade, or any archaeological convention as this one, always attracts a good number of people. We had given our talk the title The Book and the Spade, referring, of course, to the Bible and archaeology, but it has another significance, the interrelation between the humanities and the sciences today, and namely the merging of the creative human mind of science and the moral and spiritual heritage of history and religion. This too should go together. In sum, two important points have to be taken into account in considering the relation of archaeological research to the Bible. First, we have to distinguish between the facts brought to light by the excavation of biblical sites and the interpretation of those facts. Second, I wish to reiterate emphatically that archaeology can neither affirm or disprove the truth of the Bible. As my teacher in England, the Reverend Edward Robertson, used to tell us all the time, the ultimate truth of the Bible is spiritual and lies beyond the realm of archaeology. In the case of the Dead Sea Scrolls, after an attempt by two or three scholars and sensationalist writers to alarm the public by their misinterpretation of the text, numerous translations were made and excellent objective ones have also been published. And by the way, I'm sure I don't have to tell this audience here that they were not found in the Dead Sea. I say that because really I was often asked to speak about the scrolls found in the Red Sea and even in the Deep Sea. And my son always asked me when he was young, what's all this fuss about this Dead Sea squirrels? Today, many fine attempts at objective interpretations of archaeological finds have been made by a number of scholars. I believe that the scholars today that are involved, most of them, are attempting to take into account honestly and unreservedly the whole true archaeological evidence. And in the final count, what more can one expect? In sum, I'd like to quote what the true scholars are seeking to take over from biblical archaeology is the flame that it kindled in our hearts and minds, and not the ashes of its ruins. Biblical archaeology has indeed kindled a flaming and illuminating torch for our discipline. Its relevance for us Americans today, especially in this age of technology, is timely and established. Happy are those who are able to enjoy its flood of light and its warmth. Thank you.